through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
The game's all here. Look at that. Jake Heaps back in studio in the flesh. Sad, I'm assuming, to leave your home stew that was in the shed. You had a nice chair. You had your candy machine. You had deer in the yard, wildlife all around, and yet here you are with Curtis and me.
Oh, it's great. It's great, Stacy. I do miss it. But you know what? It's good to have some normalcy. It's good to be back in here. And I can't wait. And you know what I can't wait? I can't wait for what we're about to talk about.
I was going to say, it's perfect that you're in here because we got to have a little more excitement, a little more firing people up about the Seahawks' upcoming wildcard matchup against the Rams. It's going to be the third time these two teams have faced off. This one, obviously, being the final, the first one in the postseason. You got to win in advance, survive in advance. That's going to be the theme of the week. And the Rams are also, in my opinion, going to be the toughest defense this team has faced. Now, the first two contests were really tough. Rams take the first one, Seahawks take the second, and that one helps them win the division. Aaron Donald believes that this third time around is really going to be the tiebreaker. Jake, though, you said when we were doing our show prep, our show prep meeting that you, me, and Curtis have, that, you know what, of anyone, there's one person that's going to benefit the most from this third meeting. Who was it?
Yeah, the person that's going to benefit the most, in my mind, is going to be Russell Wilson and the Seahawks offense. And I get that there's a lot of people doubting this offense and that you're facing the number one defense. And I don't expect it to be fireworks. I don't expect it to, you know, this offense to come out and put on a 30-point show by any means. But I expect them to be more efficient. And what I do believe has happened and what has transpired is that second half of that game that they had against the Rams last time around, where Russell Wilson was 10 of 13, over 150 yards passing and two total touchdowns, I think it was very similar to like Rocky III, Stacy, and I know you're a big fan of Rocky.
Huge fan. Rocky,
but Rocky
and his friends.
Rocky goes to Russia.
Okay.
He goes to fight Ivan Drago.
Uh-oh.
And for the first time in that matchup, Rocky is taking hit after hit.
Oh, no.
And at one point, the fight changes. He makes him bleed. And here's what happens after that moment.
Teddy, you're hurting. You see? He's not a machine. He's a man.
You see that, Stacey? They're not a machine. This Rams defense, they're not a machine. They're more men, more mortals, okay? And what happened in that second half with Russell Wilson, that offense, being able to effectively move the ball up and down the field, to be able to go and control the game in the second half, to be able to, one, come out from the very beginning in that first drive and put points up on the board, and then be able to, in the fourth quarter with 7 minutes left to go in the game, to march down the field and throw that beautiful touchdown to Jacob Hollister at the end to basically seal it. That, to me, is a confidence-building moment. That, to me, is a moment just like with Rocky against Ivan Drago and making him bleed and seeing that he's not a machine but that he is a man. That was the turning point in that fight. I think that this is the turning point in the Seahawks offense and their ability to be able to be effective against this Rams defense.
Now, listen to what Aaron Donald had to say about this game right here.
We played them twice a year. You know, we won the first game. They got the best of us the second game. And, you know, now it's like more like the, you know, the tiebreaker. You know, they got the division and they was happy about that. Now they got to see us again for a third time. And, you know, when you're playing a team that you play twice a year, you kind of got a feel for each other. They know what you're going to do. We know what they're going to do. It's pretty much man on man now. Best team going to win. So, you know, you wouldn't want it no better way than that to start it off. So
familiarity had a lot to do with that you know those guys so well?
Yeah, then they beat us last time too. So that's just much more. So, yeah.
Given Aaron Donald a little more fire that the Seahawks managed to beat them last time. Now, I understand if people look at this game and they say, hey, of all the wild card games, I can see the Rams as the best potential to upset. They are just 4-point underdogs, meaning it's essentially a toss-up since it'll be a home game for Seattle. when people look at this game, they see what's been a relatively lethargic Seahawks offense compared to their first five, six games of the season, and certainly a more unpredictable offense since you've had some games where they've been stellar and some drives when they've been stellar and then other ones when they've fallen flat. I understand why people would look at this number one ranked Ram defense, would look at Aaron Donald, and would look at Leonard Floyd, would look at Jalen Ramsey, and would say they're going to have a hard time. They are going to have a hard time beating this defense, but make no mistake, they will have a hard time. It'll be a tough go of it. If you take the Rams, you're also taking, in my opinion, John Wolford over Russell Wilson, because you have to count on John Wolford putting up points against the Seahawks defense. And Jake, we spoke the other day about why it might be a bit weird to doubt the Seahawks defense against a backup quarterback when the narrative, even again from critics, has been that they've only succeeded playing backup quarterbacks. So why would that suddenly change with you know, the second coming of Joe Montana, John Wolford? But you can still count that the offense will find a way to score. Now, Jake, that doesn't mean I don't have questions.
Of course, I didn't assume that.
You know me. Now, I am going to take the Seahawks in this one. That's obvious. I have plenty of worries for this team moving forward, but this team is better than the Rams. The Rams' offense is one of the worst offenses entering the postseason. The Seahawks, at their best, is one of the top offenses. They're middle of the road right now because they don't consistently reach that. But what critics are pointing to, Jake, and what I'll ask you right now, is that what teams have effectively been able to take away from them has been what made them so explosive, which are those deep passes, yes, to Tyler Lockett, but also to DK Metcalf. DK Metcalf has not had the 100-plus yard games or 99-yard games that he was having earlier this season. There was a time when he and DeAndre Hopkins were leading the league 1 and 2 in yards per game. He hasn't had that really since Philadelphia when he went off for 177 yards.
Right.
So I think people look at that and they say, all right, well, what happens when you take away DK Metcalf? And the second question is, doesn't look like the Seahawks are adjusting much. They're still winning, but they aren't being nearly as effective as they were earlier.
Well, I also do think that you have to point to the fact that this group has not played with the same offensive line since week five. I mean, with the same group, the same core, and with their same starting five, now they finally have everybody back and healthy. And that's not to say that Jordan Simmons hasn't played well at times. It's not to say that Cedric Obuehi didn't play well at times, but come on. They're not the starting, they're not starting caliber offensive linemen in this league for a reason, and they did their jobs effectively to come in to fill in as a backup in a short role in a short period of time. And guess what? Jordan Simmons and Cedric Obuehi also had to play against some of the best defensive lines in the NFL towards the end of the season. So I also believe that there has not been as much time as there was at the beginning of the year as well. So when you were scoring over 35 points per game at the beginning of the year, there was a significant difference in the amount of time that Russell Wilson had in the pocket as well. And that's not necessarily to put blame solely on the offensive line. That's just to say that you finally have this group back. They're healthy, they're ready to go, and I do think that that will make a difference. When you talk about taking deep shots down the field, guess what? You need time. When you take an opportunity to get somebody like DK Metcalf involved, you need time to run some of those deeper routes down the field. In this particular matchup, DK Metcalf, guess what? I'm sorry, Jalen Ramsey, close your ears, plug your ears, because this is going to make you mad, apparently, but yeah, you got to move DK Metcalf around. You can't just, you know, sit there and play a one-on-one game between him and Jalen Ramsey. That's not high percentage. You need to move DK around like they did the second time and to be able to utilize and effectively attack some of the weaker areas of the Rams defense and to use your playmaking weapon in DK Metcalf to be able to do that. So I think those are a couple areas to me that stands out. The other couple areas that stand out to me too is that when this offense uses tempo, when they go in up-tempo situations, and I don't mean 2 minute, but they change the tempo within a drive. One play, they'll go up-tempo. The next play, they'll play it in a normal tempo. When you keep things constantly changing, you don't allow defenses to get comfortable. And for this Rams defense in particular, they're what we call a match team. So everything is predicated off of I talked about earlier in the week trying to create two-on-ones as an offense. Well, defensively, they try to create two-on-ones themselves. And so when you motion and you shift and you do those types of things, it really stresses the Rams' coverage in particular because they have to communicate everything. Who's in and outing? Who's doubling up this receiver, that receiver? More so than most defenses, way more than the Seattle Seahawks defense. And so when you can do that, I think play with great tempo, move guys around before the snap. I think that that gives them a better chance to be more in attack mode instead of being on their heels. And guess what? You've got Aaron Donald, Leonard Floyd. You've got this great pass rush that's able to sit back, be comfortable, and pin their ears back and rush the passer. Now you're more dictating to them a little bit in a natural way. That I think would be successful for them.
I have another point that I wanted to make. Before I get to that, though, I just thought of a question when you were talking. How much of dictating when you go up-tempo within a drive, so not necessarily part of like, hey, this is our game plan heading into this two-minute drill, but hey, we're in a drive. It's the middle of the second. When you decide within a drive, one possession is going to be up-tempo, and then we're going to go to a traditional huddle and then another. Is that up to the quarterback more often than not, or is that shoddy calling?
Well, it is between quarterback and play caller. Typically, it's going to be from your play caller. Your offensive coordinator is going to say, hey, we want to go more in an up-tempo situation. Maybe we want to throw out a different package that we've been practicing through the offseason or during the week that allows us to go more up-tempo. Or it's the quarterback and Russell Wilson. I think at this point, obviously, you have the control and the say to be able to do that.
Headset's broken. Sorry, Shoddy. Gotta go up tempo.
I don't know if it would be full rogue. I think it would be an understanding pregame we will take advantage of some of these situations or during the game. Hey, we need to adjust when we get a successful play or hey, during the drive, we need to change it up in terms of our tempo. I think that that's more of a collective effort in terms of identifying that. And it was very clear to me that in the fourth quarter, they decided to go more up-tempo, that they decided to put the pressure on San Francisco's defense instead of sitting back and trying to play ball control and trying to play the time of possession game. This was we're as an offense going to be in attack mode. And obviously the game dictated that to them, but that's when this offense has been at its best. And when everybody's talking about how this group scored 30 points a game, well, that's what it looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Great tempo, great movement in and out of the huddle, coming up to the line of scrimmage, dictating to the defense what you're going to do. And so I think they have to mix in a little bit of that as well if they're going to be successful versus this Rams defense, if they're going to be more successful on third down, Stacey. And that's the area that we obviously are going to consistently point to. And here in cut number one, Brian Schottenheimer actually brings up this point on, Stacey, you ask about explosive plays. Schottenheimer actually explains that a little bit and how it correlates to third down.
Well, yeah, I think it certainly helps you score points. You know, you get big explosive plays and it puts points on the scoreboard or it switches momentum. But we've shown, Bob, that we can do it the other way as well. We can kind of, you know, if they make us throw it underneath or run the football, we can still go and execute. I mentioned last week, one of the things that, you know, we need to be better at is we need to control the football more offensively. You know, I think this is the third straight game that we're at 27 minutes. You're going to have limited opportunities for explosives. And where does that start? That starts with us being better on third down in the first half of football games. We have to be better.
So you have to be better in that area to create that time of possession. If you've been frustrated that Chris Carson has only had 15 to 18 carries a game, well, guess what? How you get to 2025 is not necessarily by forcing the issue. It's by the offense being able to sustain drives, for this offense to be able to take more shots, for it to be able to get into the entire playbook that you have scripted and planned out in a given game. When you limit those plays, it becomes very, very hard for you to accomplish, you know, all the pillars that you have designed for yourself as an offense.
Yeah, but I find myself teetering back and forth on how many chances you should take within that, right? Like, I know your full playbook doesn't open up until you're moving the chains and you really get a chance, but I think that with a team that has been so exceptionally concerned with ball control, which is good. It's a pillar of a good team, right? Don't turn over the ball. That is, there's a strong correlation between losing games and giving your opponent more possessions. It is a very obvious mistake that causes a loss. But that said, I think that there were turnovers midseason with Russell Wilson, and it feels at times like there's been a bit of hesitation. I'm not saying it's just coming from Wilson. I think with this team, I'm making sure that they don't do that again. And I know it's easy to say. And I know it's easy to say when you're playing with house money, like I am. I'm not going to be fired if this team throws an interception or loses a game. And I can sit here and say, "Hey, take some chances." But hey, take some chances. There are times when you're going to have a split second decision with Russell Wilson and DK Metcalf. Russell Wilson knows this, but I also think that collectively as a team, they might be leaning more toward protecting the ball than in taking risks.
Yes,
and
they are.
And it's so easy to say that because people right now are hearing that and thinking, well, Stacey, when they were taking risks, you had Buffalo. You had two interceptions, two lost fumbles. You had the Arizona Cardinals when you had three interceptions. But also, that's what winning teams do when to their best players. Give your top receivers. Your receivers are top 10 or top 5 in multiple categories.
Mm-hmm.
Total yardage, receptions, targets. Give them a shot.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating combination of the turnovers that happened, right? It is a fine line because guess what? When you're even to plus in the turnover margin in the turnover battle, you're 12-0, right? So it's very easy to go down that logic if you're Pete Carroll in this group who is fundamental belief is that it's all about the ball. It's all about protecting the ball. And guess what? The stats this season back that up 100%. But when you have an offense, it is definitely about, when you look at this group now, it's partly because of the great defenses that they've played down the stretch. There's no doubt in my mind about that. It has also been because you have taken a more conservative approach in every aspect, of this offense, particularly in the approach and the decision-making that you have gone about through the games. And finally, when you talk about, when I come back to that offensive line, well, you're not going to take as many shots down the field when you feel like you don't have time, when you don't feel like you're able to create that time on a consistent basis. As a play caller, you're not confident in that. As a quarterback, you're not fully confident in that. And so what you have to do in the meantime is you have to be able to run the ball effectively. You have to be able to get the ball to your hands quickly and attack the underneath coverage. And I think all those things have to come together. But I am hopeful, Stacey, that, again, coming back to the offensive line, that with Mike Iupati, with Brandon Schell coming back, and Brandon Schell really being the biggest key of all of this, is that you can get back to feeling more confident in the protection, in your offense, in your running game, because you have more of a cohesive group that is working well together. So they are at full strength. They're at full strength, and they're as healthy as you could ask this Seahawks team to be. There's no excuses. It's time to go out there. It's time to go execute, and it's about sustaining drives. It's about being able to, off of those sustained drives, generate those explosive plays. But Curtis, I want to play that for everybody one more time. Just remember that this Seahawks offense in the second half of that second game against the Rams, they showed that they can move the ball up and down the field when they want to.
Cut it! You heard it! You see? He's not a machine! He's a man!
And for everybody out there that was pointing it out to me, I'm sorry. I apologize. It wasn't Rocky 3. It's Rocky 4. I knew it. I knew that. I said the wrong word.
Jake getting torn apart on the Vizzy Hard
Rocky
3,
I get it. I get it. That was Mr. T. But you know what? You get the point.
Jake's not a machine. He's a human.
That's right. I make mistakes.
Human mistakes.
That's right. I know some of you guys think I'm a machine. I am not. I'm not. I make mistakes. Just like the Rams, they are not a machine, and they the Seahawks defense, they or the Seahawks offense, they cut them. They showed them that they are a group that can be taken advantage of, that can be beat. And I expect this offense the third time around to be more effective throughout the game than they have been in the first two times they've matched up.
It is time for three questions brought to you by Thielen Mortgage.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 11:15, three burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
That's the dumbest question you could ask.
What? Let's look around the NFL for this one. Which quarterback playing on Wild Card Weekend is under the most pressure?
I got my answer.
Okay. I think I've got my answer, too.
Let's say it on three. One, two, three. Trubisky.
Russell Wilson.
You know what? I think you're right, but you go first.
I think it's Russell Wilson. I think that there's so many people that are doubting Russell Wilson and this offense and what they're doing. And you know, gosh, is Russell any good anymore? Is this offense any good anymore? There's been such a transition. If the Seahawks lose this weekend, man, there's going to be a lot of questions that are asked, not just about the quarterback, but as the team in general. But I do believe that there's a lot of pressure on Russell Wilson to come through in this game just because of that narrative more so than anything else. It's not like there's going to be a long-term implication that, okay, if he loses this game, what do we do with Russell Wilson?
Right.
It's not anything like that. But I just think from the narrative, the conversation, it's amazing to me that people are doubting Russ as much as they are right now. But Trubisky's a good answer.
Well, Trubisky, I was thinking more immediate future. Now, Trubisky isn't going to convince any Bears fans, maybe like five that have just spent a little too much money on Trubisky jerseys and don't want to have to not have a chance to use that.
Mm-hmm.
Trubisky isn't going to convince many people he's the franchise quarterback and star of the future for the Bears, but he is trying to play for another prove-it deal. So you've got some money on the line in this one. That hopefully you can make just a little bit more if the Bears are convinced, like, oh, why don't we just keep him around and see how far we can take this. So the more immediate future, more immediate pressure, Trubisky. But I love that Russell Wilson argument because what I will say, this, in my opinion, is the most kind of closely divided wild card game within the NFC. There's some other close contests in the AFC, but I think the most favored wild card team, outside of clearly people taking the Bucks over Washington, are thinking that the Rams and John Wolford, presumably, are going to upset Russell Wilson in no small part due to the offense's performance. And that's come with doubt about Russell Wilson.
Number two.
Rams left tackle Andrew Whitworth is expected to play on Sunday after tearing his, or on Saturday, I should say, after tearing his MCL less than 2 months ago. How many years would it take for you to fully recover from that same injury?
Oh, man.
Stacey, you're the most recent injured of us.
Yeah, I am still recovering from my fall down the stairs.
Okay, so what you're saying
is... Both my pride and my back.
You'd be out a year.
I'd be out of commission until the year 2025. I'd be done.
Well, I 2025, I think you'd be healthy by then.
I don't know.
Rehabbing. Stacey, when you put your mind to it, you're scrappy.
I'm exceptionally out of shape.
Well, okay. But I do think that in 2025, you'd still be complaining about it. I have no doubt about that.
Absolutely.
I have zero
Jake.
Doubt
yes.
about that.
You know, no, I have a sick desire for attention at all times. I'd be talking about it every day.
I think for me, right now, in my current state, it wouldn't take me 2 months. It would take me double that.
Yeah.
2 months.
For sure. I mean, that's.
Was he not carted off the field?
Because
that was from KJ.
I'm 3 months removed from surgery, and I still got a little bit of a hitch in my getting.
And he's not a young guy anymore.
He's almost 40.
Yes. That is insane. Props to Whitworth.
But it goes to show you, if you continue to keep yourself in shape and you continue to keep working out, I mean, it benefits you.
All right.
Gross.
Number three.
Big trade in baseball.
Couldn't be me.
Yeah. No, thank you. Big trade in baseball this morning. Cleveland sending Francisco Lindor to the New York Mets. Price tag the Mets had to pay, not very steep. Mm. So does it disappoint you that the Mariners could have likely also afforded that price tag?
Yes, they could have afforded this price tag easily. Easily they could have made this trade for Francisco Lindor. And we're actually going to get into this a little bit more in depth at 11:45. And I'm actually really looking forward to this conversation. But you see that trade and... It would have been no skin off of the Mariners' back right now if they had made this same type of deal that the Mets made for Francisco Lindor. I'm actually really shocked that that's all the Mets had to give up.
Discipline is the shortcut, Jake. Discipline is the shortcut.
Is that original?
That's a Stacey Ross original.
Oh, okay.
It's, you know what? I am fine with them holding off. This is part of the plan. If you weren't going to make a move, don't make a move. I don't care if it's a generational player. I'm sticking to my guns. Even if I'm proven wrong, I will continue to stick to my guns on this one. We'll get into this at 45. Hey, don't miss the Seahawks playoff roundtable today from 3 to 4 p.m. on Wyman and Bob. Every weekday during the playoffs, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton are joined by a cast of our NFL experts with an inside look at the Hawks. The Seahawks playoff roundtable daily, 3 to 4 p.m. on the home of the Seahawks playoff run, 710 ESPN Seattle. Now, we've been having a special guest fill in for Mike Salk, who normally joins us. He'll join us again next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Normally, Mike Salk joins us at 11:30 every weekday on Jake and Stacey, but today we're bringing on the Graz, brought to you by Jacko Plumbing and Sewer. Hey, Graz.
How's everyone doing today?
We're good. We're good. Getting ready for this upcoming matchup. Graz, it seems like a common theme throughout the week and one that Jake and I can't get away from, despite my own questions about the Seahawks team and Seahawks offense, is the idea that people are genuinely taking John Wolford over Russell Wilson. Are you in that boat?
Really?
Yes. This is really happening, Graz. It's really happening. Well, what people are doing is taking Aaron Donald over Russell Wilson. They are saying the Rams defense is so good, and the Seahawks offense has had such lethargic first halves and quarters that we count on all the Rams offense is going to need to do is just enough. And so I think that's the thought process.
I gotcha. Look, I mean, the Seahawks, it's crystal clear. It was clear from the opening snap. It was clear from the contract when he signed it back a couple years ago that this team is Russell Wilson's team and it'll go as far as he takes them, even if it's limited, even if it's, you know, the run first offense and doing what they're doing. And look, I mean, this is I happen to agree with everyone. If they're talking about this being a tough matchup, I agree with that 1,000%. I think it's going to be a very tough matchup. Third time against the Rams team that has the best defense in the league, and there have been examples over the years of teams that have ridden very far with a lousy quarterback, but with great defense. Even the Rams themselves did it back in 1979 with a guy that Jake remembers named Dieter Brock, who was the quarterback from the Canadian League, but they had Jack Youngblood and a great defense, and actually Vince Ferragamo played in the Super Bowl, but they lost to the Terry Bradshaw Steelers. But that was kind of the first example of a great defense taking a team in there. So the Rams have the best defense in the league. We know what they're like against the Seahawks. We know this is a game Russell Wilson's gonna struggle, but the Seahawks win it if he can find a way to make a big play or two. I don't think it'll take much more than that, because I don't think the Rams offense is going to do all that much either. Russell Wilson will have to step up. It will come to the point of the fourth quarter. The game is going to be up for grabs. And I can't believe that in a tight playoff game, you'd rather have someone who's never played or is playing his second game versus Russell Wilson to win it in the fourth quarter. I'll take my shot with Russell.
Well, it's a great point that you make, Graz, because you look at Russell and what this offense did last time around, they did come up big in the second half of this game. They came up big. Russell Wilson, 10 of 13, 150 yards passing, two total touchdowns when they needed it, and a passing touchdown in the fourth quarter when they needed it. Do you, as you just said, you believe that this is the guy that you would love to have in these moments?
Yeah.
So why do people doubt that? Why, when you know it's going to be this type of a slugfest, why would you not want to have this guy under center in this type of matchup? He just seems like he's made for these moments.
Sure does. And, I mean, you won a Super Bowl with him, so you know that he can do it. I think fans sometimes tend to think that you see stuff happen in the fourth quarter. And why didn't that happen all game long? Why aren't they playing that way the whole game? Well, part of what football is, and Jake, you know this, of course, is you're setting up your opponent. Yeah, part of the game is the chess match that the coaches are playing with each other with defensive formations and offensive formations. You show certain things
right
in order to, you know, make a play later in the game. So that's how the game is set up. So, of course, they're going to look like they're slow because they're kind of figuring things out a little bit. I mean, everyone would love to win every game 50 to nothing, but that's what people seem to expect. They seem to forget, A, there's another team out there, and B, that's not the way you win football games. You win football games by setting teams up I mean, I love the Pete Carroll philosophy of winning in the fourth quarter. That's the best way to go. And then have a team, whether they're worn out, you can run it down their throat, or you've been fooling them on play action for the whole game, and it's time to make your big hit. That's how you play it. And you've got a quarterback who has executed those plays over the years. So I kind of understand people looking at Russell and saying, geez, he was so much better at the start of the year. He doesn't seem as strong now. That's a legitimate concern. But I'm sorry, in the fourth quarter, I'm taking that guy who's cool as a cucumber, who believes in himself, and I think that's your best shot. Now, you may not win every time. That's one thing. But you're not here. You're not winning all these games. This isn't happening without Russell Wilson.
And one of the narratives also of this week, and it's really not a narrative, it's just a simple fact that you're finally healthy with the Seahawks offensive line. How big of a difference do you think that will make in this matchup with the Rams group that has such a fierce pass rush and really has been the biggest problem for the Seahawks offense? How big of a difference do you think that is for this group to get Mike Iupati and Brandon Shell back?
I think in general it's a big difference. It probably has the least impact, though, in this game. Unfortunately, it does. I mean, you know, the Rams still have what they have. You know, I don't care who you've got. You know, if you've got everyone playing their first game and healthy and not even a nick on them, they're going to have a problem with Aaron Donald. They're going to have a problem with Brockers and the other guys they have in that line. So, you know, we have seen this game before. We've seen it multiple times a year. I think it's good news for the Seahawks in general. I don't think it's something that dramatically shifts the equation in this game. It's not like the Seahawks, when their offensive line was healthy, were dominating the Rams anyway. So it's good news for the Hawks. It has a small impact in this game, but not a big impact. I still have seen nothing that convinces me otherwise that this game is not going to be a low-scoring affair. It's going to come down to a touchdown in the fourth quarter for either side, and I will not be surprised at all if both teams are under 20 points in this one.
Turning to the MLB here, Groz, if you were Jerry DePoto, yeah, would you have made a move for Francisco Lindor?
Francisco Lindor is a transcendent player, and if you've watched baseball at all, he's the perfect guy to have around. He's the perfect guy to build around. That having been said, he's making $19 million this year, which is not a factor. The factor is he's a free agent next year. He's looking at a $250 to $300 million deal. I'm not afraid of that, but I'm afraid of him not signing. So if you're Jerry and you're trying to put this thing together and you're willing to sacrifice some really key prospects to move forward, you'd have to have certainty that you could re-sign him. And I imagine there were some conversations there, and I imagine they got a sense that, well, we can't guarantee you that, and I would think that Lindor might like the idea of being in New York, who wouldn't, and having the big spotlight. So, sure, he's a player that I would love to have. He's an absolute guy to build it around. But with the fact that he's a free agent after next year, unless you had some certainty, unless you could even sign the contract when you're announcing the deal, kind of similar to what they did with Cano, no, I don't think it was a deal that Jerry DePoto could have made.
Now, Groz, I totally understand that, and I think that it's very, very crucial in this,
conversation
that you can't guarantee him coming back, so therefore it's not necessarily the deal that you should make. My question to you is, do you think the Mariners, this franchise, this organization, this ownership group, Jerry DePoto himself, that Francisco Lindor, this is an organization that you could see Francisco Lindor, after being here a year, say, you know what, I actually would love to be a Mariner for the long term?
What do you mean? Believe that, just go on faith and hope that you can convince them to stay?
Yeah, well, what I mean is that do they have the power to make a star player like that happy, right? Like from
sure,
every aspect and from this organization, do you believe that they are in a position where they could keep a legitimate star player happy like this?
Sadly, that is yet to be proven for the Mariners. I mean, you cannot look at what they've been and the longest playoff drought in sports and get a player to believe the fact that you've turned the corner until you have. Now, what you've got to offer is money. I mean, what you can do is we can show you the equipment we're going to make. Here you go. And if they could have done that with Lindor, you do it. And that will eventually be the thing that gets other players excited and gets you to believe in them. So, I hear what you're saying, Jake, and I don't know that I believe that the Mariners have created that kind of environment yet. A signing like Lindor, and they're going to need to do something like that. It's just what San Diego did with Machado, kind of got their ball rolling. will definitely be a part of the plan, but you can't just sign him for a year. If you sign him for a year and lose him, it just sets you back too much because your farm system isn't quite developed enough yet.
He is the Groz. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you, guys. Talk to you tomorrow.
All right. Talk to you then. First, it was Blake Snell. Now it's Francisco Lindor landing with another team. We know the Mariners are planning for the future, but are they letting too many opportunities go by? We've got a divided show on Jake and Stacey when it comes to this one. We're making our case next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. Jake Heaps, Stacey Ross here. The Mariners may have let another opportunity go by. In fact, Jake and producer Curtis Rogers both arguing their case that the Mariners did do that. I don't know that they did. In fact, I'm going to say that they didn't because we are all about discipline here. That's Jerry DePoto's stance. From Tuesday's Hot Stove Show, he said 2021, it's all about developing talent.
While we believed at the beginning of this that 2021 would be the year where we could really step into that contending window, we're going to be a little more conservative in how we view that. We still think that we're improving. We do think that we have a chance to be on the back end of contention for a postseason spot, one of those wild card spots, if things break in the right way for us. But we want this season to be about the continued development of the young players. And perhaps by the midpoint of this season, before we get to the traditional trade deadline, yeah, we can see that big step that leads us into a really exciting stage in Mariners baseball.
Now, we've had debates about whether or not you'd ever give up Julio Rodriguez or Jared Kelnick for any kind of potential star. And all of us have said no. Stick with your guns. You've built this phenomenal farm system after not having that for so long, or trading those prospects away too early, or trying to develop them too early and having them struggle in the big. So stick to your guns on this one. But here's where the debate comes in. When do you veer from that course when, A, the person you're going to land is a generational talent like Francisco Lindor? And when do you do that when what you're giving up wouldn't be that significant? Because when it comes to the Mets in their trade for Lindor, they didn't give up a ton. They gave up, Cleveland received two shortstops that are big league shortstops, Ahmed Rosario and Andrés Giménez, and two top 10 minor league prospects, though not like a 1-2-3. We're talking like 9-10. Curtis, what did you say they were in their farm system?
About
9-10, yeah, in their farm system. Josh Wolf and Isaiah Green, right-hander and outfielder. So they don't give up a ton. I mean, that would be equivalent to the Mariners trading away J.P. Crawford, maybe another current big leaguer, and then two, I don't want to say lower-end prospects, but they're not giving up Kelnick. They're not giving up Gilbert. They're not giving
like
up
Hancock.
Kind of
like a Taylor Trammell, something,
yeah,
like that.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to say that this is an achievable trade where the Mariners would not have sacrificed their future. But if you are sticking to your guns, the case that I'm making, you don't do this trade. Now, there is a good case to be made on the other side, so I'm going to let you guys take this one first.
To me, as I look at this potential trade, I actually side with, when it's all said and done, I do believe that the Mariners made the right decision, because as you just listened to that Jerry DePoto cut, due to COVID, they got pushed back in their development. If it wasn't for COVID and they were able to go through this year and they were able to have Kelnick come up and play, they were able to get Julio Rodriguez an opportunity, they were able to get Logan Gilbert up, they were able to get some of those guys up that were on their original timeline, then they would be feeling very differently about this 2021 season. But I do want to make this argument in this case, and I know Curtis Rogers will have, you know, his side of this story.
Let's go.
But in terms of the opportunity that you have for Francisco Lindor, and I know that down the line you're going to have a chance at Corey Seager, Trevor Story, Carlos Correa, Andrés Giménez. Like, you're going to have those opportunities at some of those guys. But Francisco Lindor is a special, special talent and is a great defensive player. He's a great player at the plate. So what you have is one opportunity, kind of like Jamal Adams, one that you probably very few times will have an opportunity to get a guy like this in particular. And if you feel like you are close, and clearly Jerry DePoto does not, but if they felt like they were close and that through that year when they had him, that they could convince him that they were close and that he could be the really the centerpiece around it, and that through Seattle, I mean, could you imagine? I mean, just look at Edgar Martinez and Ken Griffey Jr. and all of the Mariner greats. Guess what?
When you're a star here.
We still have Edgar Martinez night or Ken Griffey Jr. night or Ichiro night.
It will be Francisco Lindor bobblehead night in 2035.
That's right. Exactly. And you would be a legend here. And I think that if you really feel like you could convince him that this group is a legitimate playoff contending team, a young playoff contending team, I think that's where it becomes very interesting to me, and he could be the springboard into that potentially.
I look at people who are okay with the Mariners letting this one go by, and there's been a lot of people saying, well, they've already got J.P. Crawford. He's a Gold Glove caliber shortstop. Like, he's fine. But J.P. Crawford is only 14 months younger than Francisco Lindor. So it's not like they're very far off in where they should be as players. Lindor clearly in his prime. Crawford, a late developer, should be entering his prime right now, but the bat still leaves a lot to be desired. Francisco Lindor is a silver slugger. He's an MVP candidate. He hits 30-plus home runs and is a two-time Gold Glove winner, which is twice as many as J.P. Crawford has. So it's not like you're going to be, you know, losing any sort of defensive production that Crawford does bring to the table. That, to me, it, you know, the similarities in age and just the exponentially better production that Lindor has brought to the table should have made this a much bigger deal, I guess, for people that are saying, oh, well, we've got J.P. Crawford here.
Right, but what if you can't get Lindor to stay? Because that's the argument that Mariners insider for 710 Shannon Dreher made. She said, look, I understand what people are saying. This could have been a very achievable trade, but what happens if they can't convince Lindor to stay?
Well, if you can't get him to stay, it's not like you're going to be running out of opportunities to acquire shortstops, because you look at the upcoming free agent class.
But then you no longer have J.P. Crawford or two prospects.
But you can also get guys who are better than J.P. Crawford, guys like Javi Baez and Carlos Correa and Corey Seager, like Jake pointed out right there. There, you can do away, or like, yeah, you lose Francisco Lindor after 2021 if you acquire him. You're out those prospects, but you're not out the opportunity to go spend on some other shortstop that you don't have to give up prospects for.
Mm. And it all comes back to me is ultimately, I do believe this was probably the right decision. And I don't think probably. I do think it was the right decision, even though Francisco Lindor, we were talking about this at show prep. Is there one player, you know, that the Mariners in their building, that they have a quote that says discipline is the shortcut? When they talk about how they're going to rebuild this thing and how they're going to make the Mariners competitive again, discipline is the shortcut. That is the mantra that they have. Is there one player out there that would make you crumple that up and throw it away, knowing that they could help springboard you into that a little bit sooner? I think Francisco Lindor is one of those players. Is there anybody else out there that would put that into question?
If you're going to be sticking to your guns on that one, if you really think discipline is the shortcut, when you're ready to crumple that up and make a move for someone before you were otherwise planning to be ready, then you were never sticking to that in the first place.
Mm. I don't necessarily agree with that. What if there was a generational pitcher that is young and talented?
I'd be tempted on that one.
I think that there are guys that have the mental makeup to be a leader in the clubhouse. I mean, look, Robinson Cano, he wasn't that guy. I mean, very obviously, he wasn't that guy. He turned out to be not that guy that you wanted as your star player and your leader in the clubhouse. But if there was a pitcher, if there was a superstar player out there that could be both of those things, I think that they would be worth it, because they're a centerpiece still around that rebuild. Now, the problem is that the Mariners just simply aren't there yet. Their initial target date was 2021. That's been pushed back, and that's the most important thing. So when you talk about discipline is the shortcut, that's what I feel encouraged about in this, is that Jerry DePoto, this Mariners organization, they have stuck to their guns. They are trusting in the plan, and ultimately they will make a move like this when they feel like they are just about to get to that point. Just 2021 is not that time.
That's fair. That's fair. All right. NFL Network analyst Bucky Brooks joins us next because we're going to take a look at the entire wild card weekend matchups as well as his outlook on the Seattle Seahawks. That's next.